Welcome to Sci-Fi on Screen, the podcast that goes where no podcast has gone before. We here at Sci-Fi on Screen take a deep, close look at your favorite genre movies of science fiction, horror, fantasy, and comic book land. We go deep, scene by scene. We do comparisons of originals and remakes, and special shows. Just ahead, a new episode. And thanks for listening. Today we're going to be talking about Bryan Singer's 2000 film, X-Men. X-Men had been in development hell, as it's called, for about 16-plus years. In 1984, these two writers from Marvel Comics, Jerry Conway and Roy Thomas, wrote a screenplay, which went nowhere, I think. And then closer to 1990, Marvel was sort of talking to Cameron and Kathryn Bigelow, you know, writing and directing. I think Cameron would produce and Kathryn Bigelow would direct an X-Men film, which, boy, that would have been a very interesting thing were it to happen. So Bigelow wrote a story treatment, and they were thinking about having Michael Biehn being cast as Cyclops because he had been in two of Cameron's films and I guess was in that inner circle. They were going to cast Bob Hoskins as the Wolverine and Angela Bassett for Storm, which would have been pretty cool. So that fell apart. I think Carolco Films, which is a company that Cameron and Bigelow were sort of part of, went bankrupt, and the film rights for it reverted back to Marvel at that point. At this point, Avi Arad produced this animated X-Men TV series for Fox Kids, and it was a very big success. I think it went for 5 seasons on Fox, and 20th Century Fox was very impressed by the success of the TV show, thinking there was something there. So producer Lauren Shula Donner bought the film rights for them in 1994. And she brought along Andrew Kevin Walker to write a script. And Andrew Kevin Walker is famous for writing Seven several years later. Walker's draft is interesting. It involved Professor Xavier recruiting Wolverine into the X-Men, which consists of Cyclops, Jean Grey, Iceman, Beast, and Angel. The Brotherhood of Mutants in that film would have consisted of Magneto, Sabretooth, Toad, as is made the final film, but Juggernaut and the Blob. And they try to conquer New York City, while Henry Peter Gyrinch, I think, Bolivar Trask, attacked the X-Men with Sentinels. Like, this is a crazy zillion-dollar movie he was writing. So part of the backstory invented for Magneto made him the cause of the Chernobyl disaster. Like, this was getting pretty heavy. So then Walker turned in a second draft in 1994, and then Leda Kalogridis, John Logan, James Shamus, and Joss Whedon were brought on for, like, successive rewrites as the decade went on. One of the ideas of these scripts was Magneto turning Manhattan into a mutant homeland, while another one hinged on a Storm-Wolverine romance. Whedon's draft featured the Danger Room and concluded with Jean Grey dressed as the Phoenix, so he had that transformation happening already. It's funny, according to Entertainment Weekly, Whedon's screenplay was rejected because of its, quote, quick-witted pop culture referencing tone, which is very much him. So I think two lines of Whedon's remained in the final film. I'll cover them when we get there. Then Michael Chabon pitched a 6-page film treatment in 1996, and it focused heavily on character development between Wolverine and Jubilee, who was in the film, included Professor X, Cyclops, Jean Grey, Nightcrawler, Beast, Iceman, and Storm. Under Chabon's plan, the villains would not have been introduced until the second film. Then Fox was considering Brett Ratner as the director of the first film, and they offered the film to actually Robert Rodriguez, who turned it down. And then following the release of Usual Suspects, Bryan Singer was looking to do a sci-fi film, and Fox offered him Alien Resurrection. But this producer, Tom DeSanto, felt he'd be more right for X-Men. And Singer turned down X-Men 3 times. He kind of really believed the comic book films were really beneath him. And then he kind of delved into the lore of the characters and the main story arcs and watched the animated series. And he kind of got hooked on the ideas of the metaphors of prejudice. Frankly, anyone can lay into the metaphors in this film about being alienated at a certain age and so on and so forth. So by 1996, Singer was signed on for the director, And this guy, Ed Solomon, was hired to write the script. But Singer then at that point went to film Apt Pupil. And then Fox said, oh, it's going to come out in Christmas 1998. And then in late 1998, missing their date, Singer and the producer sent a treatment to Fox, which they believe was perfect because it took the themes in the comic book seriously. And they were comparing Xavier and Magneto sort of like Martin Luther King and Malcolm X. So very cool. And they made Rogue a very important character because Singer realized that her mutation, which was almost like a condensation of the metaphor that he was trying to get at, the symbolism of being an ex-person, as it were. They rejected that treatment because there was, I think, there were lots of CGI they would have to use for Beast, Nightcrawler, the Danger Room. And they had to delete all that stuff before that they were green-lighted. And then Singer and DeSanto brought in Christopher McQuarrie, who was Singer's writer from Usual Suspects, and they did another rewrite. And then a guy named David Hayter rewrote the entire script, and he gets solo screenplay credit because what we're told is that he, although some of the ideas of the other writers were there, that he completely rewrote the thing, and that it's mostly his story at the end of the day. So casting is kind of interesting, too. They offered Russell Crowe first crack at Wolverine, but he turned it down. And he recommended Hugh Jackman for the part, who was unknown at the time. Other established actors wanted to play the role. And so Singer actually cast a guy named Doug Ray Scott. Scott backed out due to scheduling conflicts with Mission Impossible 2, whom he played the villain in. And then Jackman was cast 3 weeks into filming based on a successful audition that he did and, of course, you know, Crowe's recommendation. Just thought it was very interesting. I mean, he turned out to be such a key player in the franchise, and he was 3 weeks late in the back door. And Singer approached Patrick Stewart because he's a huge Star Trek fan. He had a cameo in Star Trek Nemesis, I believe. So Stewart was like first crack at him for Xavier. They were originally going to cast James Caviezel as Cyclops. But Caviezel backed out to make this movie Frequency, so they cast Marsden, who was unfamiliar with the character, so he read up on it and, you know, kind of got in line. Angela Bassett was again approached to play Storm, as was Janet Jackson, strangely enough, who both, I guess, declined. Terrence Stamp was considered for Magneto before Singer cast McKellen. Obviously, he had worked with him in Apt Pupil. And McKellen resonated with kind of the allegory of the film as it applies to gay community, as the allegory of mutants as outsiders, disenfranchised and alone, and all of that coming at puberty when the difference manifests, it really appealed to him. And so he was kind of psyched to sign on, which was great. And Singer, a little bit about Singer. I mean, he had only made, I think he made a film called Public Access. He made, obviously, The Usual Suspects, put him on the map, and then Apt Pupil with McKellen, which I kind of like. It's sort of forgotten these days, but I think it's a solid movie. After this, he went on to do X2, Superman Returns. For a while, he did nothing, and then he came back on the scene with Valkyrie and a film called Jack the Giant Killer. Ultimately, they brought him back to kind of, you know, kickstart the franchise back into gear. He directed X-Men Days of Future Past, which was released last year, is in the middle of, I think, production at some point of X-Men Apocalypse, so the follow-up film to that. So let's get to the film. We start with Singer messing with the 20th Century Fox logo, and as we see the, you know, the 20th Century Fox, we hear the drum beat and the trumpets as we normally do. We see the Fox logo up on the screen, and as we fade down, the X in Fox is kind of the last to fade, and it kind of brightens a bit before we go to black, so very clever. We go right into credits, and we have Patrick Stewart doing a voiceover. I'll quote the whole thing, quote, "Mutation, it is the key to our evolution. It has allowed us to evolve from a single-celled organism into the dominant species on the planet. This process is slow, normally taking thousands and thousands of years, but every few hundred millennia, evolution leaps forward." And then post-credits, we open up on the camera's looking at a muddy, rainy ground. It's rain-soaked, muddy street. The camera starts to rise up, and we see a title card, Poland 1944. And we know right away where we are emotionally, you know, as well. And we're following Jews who are being marched into one of the ghettos. And we see these yellow stars on their lapels. We are focusing more and more on a family of, you know, husband, wife, and child. We're doing close-ups on serial numbers tattooed onto arms. And at one point, the young boy, whose name is Eric Lenscher, is separated from his parents. The parents are brought into the work ghetto. And the boy, I guess, being too young, is separated. So there's a very intense moment of them, you know, the parents being separated. And at first, they kind of just go with it. And then as the gates close, the mother starts to scream for her child. She claws backwards, and the SS guards kind of push her into the camp. And then the boy kind of gets up. He had kind of fallen by the side of the road and was crying. And so he gets up, and he's running to his mother, and he gets right near the gate, and these SS men grab him, and he reaches out his hand, and suddenly, you know, it's great editing here. The gates start to move, and he's crying and screaming, and the gates kind of are pulled towards the boy. And they start to bend and flex, and the metal is getting deformed, and he's screaming, and the SS men can't move him, actually. They're trying to actually move him and drag him back, and they can't. Like, he's rooted to the spot. And eventually, we follow some SS man as he comes up behind the kid and hits him in the head with the stock of a rifle. And in that moment, when he drops, the gates snap back, too, which is just so cool. I mean, if you don't know anything about the X-Men, what an intro. I mean, what the hell, you know? And from my mind, man, you cannot get a more gritty, boots-on-the-ground opening to what will ultimately be a superhero film. To me, this opening to this movie sets the tone. And I'll talk about this in the summary, but I believe that Singer's film is the template to which Nolan, the Marvel Cinematic Universe, Fox, and everyone else, all the superhero films that exploded out in the 2000s and forward, they all start from this sequence of, you know, you start off you're a guy in a suit movie with something as real and gritty and as emotionally engaging as possible and get the audience on board. And then later on, when you're doing your flights of fancy, you've come from somewhere, you know. Again, I'll talk more about this in the summary. I think this film is so influential. I think it gets a very short shrift, but I think it's one of the most influential films so far of the 21st century, frankly. Now we cut to a southern suburb in America, and the title card tells us that it's a town called Meridian, Mississippi. And we see young Marie, who's our rogue. She's in her bedroom with a boy, obviously a high school student, played by Anna Paquin, who's come very big now due to True Blood. She's there with a boy, and, you know, they're flirting, and she's talking about how she wants to travel to Alaska someday and so on and so forth. And then they get this, they have this sweet moment where they kiss, but we see some weird, odd things start to happen to the boy. These veins kind of pop out on his face, and his face gets all pale. He goes into some kind of shock, and she backs away, and he looks like he's, you know, dying or in some kind of crazy shock, and she starts screaming, and the parents come up, and they're yelling to call an ambulance, and the mother tries to console the daughter, and Marie's screaming, "Don't touch me, don't touch me." So a very intense moment. And again, this really begins to encapsulate the film's themes of, you know, things happening to, you know, anybody, frankly, via, you know, adolescence when the body starts to change. And, you know, adolescence tends to be the place where your adulthood starts to emerge, you know. And I just thought it was a really great way. You know, we have the background of Magneto, and then we have the background of your average X-Man and what they may go through when they, you know, reach puberty. So very cool scene. So now we cut to a Washington, D.C. briefing. Dr. Jean Grey, played by Famke Janssen, is giving a briefing to some committee. It looks like it's a public kind of, you know, a Senate committee of some kind with some audience behind it. Now, she gives us the very real data of the movie, the fact of the movie, that mutations are triggered by the onset of puberty and or heightened physical and emotional stress. The main antagonist here we're introduced to is a guy named Senator Robert Kelly, played by Bruce Davidson, who I really like, really good actor. And the main crux here is that Kelly is pushing for all mutants there to be this sort of compulsory mutant registration. So I guess at the opening of the film, mutants can come forward voluntarily and register and kind of tell people what they do. But it's not compulsory at the moment. So, you know, again, very interesting thematically with Jews in Eastern Europe, right? And in Germany having to register or be known to some degree. So he's handed this piece of paper very dramatically of, you know, mutants who have registered with the government and the powers that they have. And he puts it down and he says there are, you know, rumors of mutants so powerful that they can even read people's minds. And as he's finishing that sentence, the camera cuts to over a shadowed person's head looking down on Kelly. And of course, it pivots, and it's Patrick Stewart as Charles Xavier, or Professor X, as it were. Then he gives this, Kelly gives his closing speech where he's very, it's very much McCarthy, you know, like we need to know what these people can do, they're not safe, so on and so forth. Then we see from, you know, Xavier's point of view, a man in an overcoat and a fedora, you know, that's kind of shadowed, also up in the gallery as well, you know, turn and walk away. Then we cut to a hallway as we see this person walking away, and we see right in the foreground of the film, you know, Xavier's wheelchair. You know, these two men know each other, right? We sort of get the main, you know, issue between them, and Magneto is basically saying, I've heard these arguments a long time ago, you know, before, and we know he's speaking directly about the Holocaust, which is an amazing metaphor. Then Charles kind of peeks into Eric's mind, and we hear Eric, by the way, played by Ian McKellen, turn around and say, what are you doing peering around in here, Charles? Because, of course, Charles can read everyone's mind. And he's looking for hope. Basically, the reveal here is that Magneto, McKellen, thinks that the human race is finished and it has evolved now into mutants and that humans no longer matter. Xavier wants the mutants and humans to live in peace, if possible. So he's working to that end. And Xavier knows for himself that this is impossible and that it's either kill or be killed, and sort of sets up their rivalry. And, you know, again, like the Holocaust scene and the scene in the South with Rogue, now we have yet another opening sequence with these two veteran actors of stage and screen inhabiting the personas of two comic book characters. But they're talking like it's All the President's Men. Like it's the dialogue is done in very measured tones. Wonderful deliveries. I mean, these guys are just soaked in charisma. And it grounds the film. Like, so far, this film has been so grounded in real-life issues. Like, this film has been set up that it is going to deal with real-life issues. And the metaphor that this film starts plays through X2 and X3, First Class. So much mileage has been gotten out of it. From the succeeding X-Men films, but it was conceived and started here. Put my little plug in for this movie. So now we cut to a winter scene, snow on the ground, and it's cold, and the title card reads Northern Alberta, Canada. And Marie, our Mississippi high schooler, gets out of a semi, and we gather that she's been hitchhiking north since the incident at her house. And inside, we're in this grimy bar somewhere in, you know, it's this roadhouse bar at somewhere up in Canada. It's great lighting, very kind of dim, and you know, there's kind of a sheen of dust or smoke in the air. It's really great, great production design. They have a cage fighting area, and this is going to be our Wolverine entrance scene. And they deliver Wolverine here in such style, because we start out, we only see Logan in shadow, right? He's drinking a beer and smoking a cigar, but his face is shadowed, and we're shooting from outside the cage. And then, you know, the other shot is him just facing facing the cage, just standing there waiting for the next guy to jump into the ring. And we don't see his face at all. So the MC is stoking the crowd. You know, you're going to let this man take your money, and some guy stands up to fight, to volunteer. In the opening rounds, he starts pounding on Wolverine, and we still don't see Wolverine's face. The camera's behind Wolverine as this guy is kind of beating the crap out of him and kicking him and punching him. And then there's this moment when Logan kind of recovers from the first beatdown. And the guy throws a punch, and Logan throws one on his knees. And we see his fist meet the other guy's fist, and we hear the Foley work. There's a clang of metal. And the guy's in agony. And then, of course, you know, it's three more hits. And each hit, we hear this little clang of metal that they put into the sound mix, which, you know, because the guy's made of metal, basically. And the guy's basically down. And then there's this moment when he's down, we get this snarling badass reveal of Logan. We get a full-on frontal shot of him just snarling and tight, angry, in amazing shape. And, I mean, Jackman just looks incredible. And just, you know, I mean, I'm sure Russell Crowe would have made a fine Wolverine as well, and I'm sure, you know, Doug Ray Scott, but boy, Jackman just really, he really sells it. You know, you'd think they already scored super high marks casting Stewart and McKellen, and here's this guy out of nowhere who's like, who is Wolverine? And then at the very end of this little sequence, you hear the MC announce, the Wolverine! So we get his character name right in that way, which is cool. So then we cut to later that night. The bar is closing up. Marie's still there. She's been sitting at the bar all night drinking water. You know, Wolverine comes to the bar, and then we get this nice little moment on TV. We get a, there's a tease about the upcoming UN summit in New York City. And there's a wonderful subtle moment when the newscaster mentions that the mutant problem will be on the agenda. We see the camera shows us both the eyes of Marie and Logan kind of swing to the TV very subtly, and then they kind of look at each other. Just a wonderful little moment, you know, a very subtle filmmaking. And then Logan is confronted by the last guy that he beat down, who wants his money back, because he says, yeah, you know, you, there's not a scratch on you, buddy. Like, I know what you are. And Logan tells him to fuck off, and the guy pulls a knife. And this is the first reveal we get of Logan Wolverine's claws. So they one hand shoots out, and he pins the guy against a wall. And then a shotgun sort of enters the frame, pointed right at Wolverine's head, which we know for Wolverine, it wouldn't even, you know, damage him. And then he snicks out the other three blades in his hand, and he cuts the shotgun in half in this little slow-mo moment. Then we're just on this freeze of him with both sets of claws out, pointed at both men. They go back in, and he basically takes his money and walks out. Then we're on the road with Logan, and he's basically driving this beat-up pickup, which has got like a, you know, a living trailer kind of on the back, and it's towing something, and he hears something, pulls over to the side of the road, and he finds that, you know, Rogue has camped out in the back, stowed away. So Logan basically says he throws her out, and he doesn't give a shit what she wants, and he drives away. But of course, right before his truck heads around the bend, we get a shot of him, like, just, he's exasperated, but he stops the truck. And he waits, and Rogue runs in and sits in the... And then we get this nice just little character moment between Logan and Rogue, right? Because their relationship is going to kind of be a bit of a through line in this film. But it's nice. I mean, it's just them chatting, you know? It's subtle, and he gives her something to eat. They get each other's name. They realize they're both mutants, and there's really good chemistry between them, and they're just both solid actors, and they're very subtle. You know, they're not trying to shoehorn in every line something like, you know, screenplay 101 tells you to do. You know, they're just having a conversation, and it's nice. You know, there's just something nice about it. And then there's this funny moment that where she says, you know, you should wear your seatbelt. And he starts to say, kid, you know, look at you. You're the last person who should be telling anybody. And this log falls in front of the truck, and obviously, you know, the truck smashes into it. And Wolverine goes careening out the window because he wasn't wearing his belt. So it's kind of funny. But something in the back of the truck, I guess, was flammable, so there's a fire. So we've got a clock ticking. They've both been knocked out momentarily, but we see Logan get up a little shaky. But Marie is trapped in the truck. Her leg is stuck. We watch her watch him, and we see as this massive head wound heals in like seconds, and she realizes kind of what his deal is. And he smells trouble, and then all of a sudden, you know, Sabretooth, played by Tyler Mane, comes out, hits him with a telephone pole, and basically knocks him unconscious. And as he sort of makes for the truck, two other figures appear behind him, basically Cyclops and Storm, in full, you know, uniform, as it were. They take him out, he retreats, and they rescue, you know, Wolverine and Rogue. So then we cut to Magneto's lair, and this is one of the ways where I think they were doing so well. And then they had to have Magneto have a lair, you know, like they were not in lair territory up until now. I mean, and even the School for Gifted Children, right? It's a mansion and it's got, you know, a complex beneath. But, you know, Xavier's lair, so to speak, we don't know where it is. It's in the side of a cliff. It's got these walkways and like they were doing good. And I feel like the Magneto's lair thing, if they had him in a place that we would recognize as being quasi-realistic, even if it had like lair-ish type of, you know, decor inside, but, you know, it's really right out of a comic book movie. And so far, you know, up until that moment, we haven't been in a comic book movie. We've been in another kind of movie that we've never seen before, a very serious movie about people with strange powers, basically. So it's just a nit, but I think they went wrong with Magneto's lair. But we do get our first glimpse of actor Ray Park, who really was famous for playing Darth Maul in 1999's A Phantom Menace and doing all of his own stunts, as he's primarily a stuntman and not an actor. Sabretooth reports his failure to Magneto. Then we get a little misdirection here. Magneto grabs Logan's dog tags because Sabretooth had grabbed them. He looks up and he says, "Where's the mutant now?" And we think right now that he's after Wolverine, as the whole movie will. Really good misdirection. I think it's very smart. So now we cut to Logan. He's on a medical table, and he comes to. Dr. Jean Grey is examining him, played by Famke Janssen again. And we see her levitate some instruments, a syringe about to inject him with something. And he explodes off the table. Really cool scene. The camera spins around. He gets behind her, incapacitates her, and then he bursts out of the med lab. Now he's kind of walking around in some underground bunker-like hallway, you know, very sci-fi. He finds some clothes, and he starts to hear this voice whisper in his ear, you know, and we can tell as the audience that it's Patrick Stewart. An elevator is opened for his availability. He jumps in, and he gets up to the mansion proper, which is the school for gifted youngsters. He gets out of the elevator, and, you know, he's in such a high alert. And this group of kids runs by, and he sneaks out of the way. And then he runs and opens up a door and pops in, and there's Xavier teaching a class, and he's just finishing up, and the students leave. And we see Bobby Drake and Kitty Pryde briefly leave. Then we get the first view of Xavier in his wheelchair as he wheels around, and then Storm and Cyclops enter. We get this very arch description, but I like it. I think Singer had a problem here, right? He's been doing so far up till now. He's been doing an extremely realistic take on a comic book world. He's been able to get away with it, right? He's not using any names. He's not, you know, speaking of substances or weird lairs, right? There's no names involved. No one knows anything about Magneto, what these things are named. These are just powerful beings. Magneto's been called Eric. It all seems very down to earth, right? But now we have to make the leap. He just does it. He just decides to have Xavier do it. He basically says, you know, this is Scott Summers, also called Cyclops, Aurora Monroe, also called Storm, you know, and it's great because he delivers it very matter-of-factly, and Cyclops and Storm stand there very matter-of-factly. And, you know, there's that momentary pause as an audience. What are you going to do with this information? And then I think with the smart moves, what they make here is the audience becomes Logan. Where Logan is like, he's smirking and laughing at all this, right? And so I think it's so smart because they want to allow the audience to identify if they're not quite on board. Logan like points at Cyclops, right? Storm. And then he turns over and he looks at Xavier and he says, what do they call you? Wheels? Right? And that was an ad-libbed line. And it's so smart because we're laughing now. So we've gotten the information, these kind of goofy comic book names. We as the audience can participate either in mocking it and thinking it's goofy by having Jackman think it's goofy, or we can go along with it by saying, hey, man, come on, these are cool hero-sounding names, and I hope Wolverine gets on board. Like, they give the audience a choice to go either way, and I think it's so smart. Xavier tells Logan about Magneto. Another great line, like, what's a Magneto? And Sabretooth, and he's just like, oh, my God, all these names. So Logan's like, you know, I'm out of here, and he wants to leave, and he grabs Scott Summers by his lapels. He says, you want to get out of my way, pal? Xavier then starts going into his head and starts telling him about his past, that what he can't remember anything beyond the moment he woke up as Wolverine. And it stuns Logan, which you can see it. Jackman's great. And he opens up a bit, you know, and he chills. Now, a little bit, we have this little bit of a montage where Xavier's walking with Wolverine, explaining about the school, why it exists. And we're given a lot of information in these sequences, in that, you know, anonymity to a mutant is the most powerful thing to protect them, and that Xavier teaches them to control their powers there. There are the lower levels, the jet, the adults who are crime fighters or X-Men, as it were. We also hear that Magneto's powers now, we get the full download that he has the ability to control metals. He asks Logan to stick around to find out why Magneto wants him. Because now, at this point, you know, the writers and the director have misdirected us to think that because Logan is so cool and he seems to be so pivotal in this world, that of course Magneto would want him, right? Very clever. We cut to Senator Kelly, who's, you know, finishing off some speech, getting into his helicopter. Actually, Toad is the pilot, and Mystique has taken the form of Kelly's aide, and they killed the guy like months ago. She's been his aide for a while. So we see her change for the first time into her full Mystique, and it's wonderful, wonderful makeup. I mean, for such an incredibly strange, I mean, you know, she's really the first full-on comic book CGI character in this film to come in. And it happens in a moment. She knocks Kelly out, jumps into the front seat of the helicopter, and we're off. And I think it's done really well. You know, we don't get a lot of it. We just get enough to, so we know what her character looks like and what she can do, basically. So now they have Wolverine back on the table at back at Xavier School for the Gifted, and he's flirting like crazy with Jean. They put him into a scanning machine, and then we get another download as she explains to Xavier, Scott, and Aurora that his entire body is laced with a substance called adamantium, that it was surgically grafted to his skeleton. And then we figure out what Wolverine's mutant power is, his mutation. He has this ability to regenerate at a ridiculous rate. And only because of his mutation was this process allowed to be perpetrated on him. Also, that he could be older than even the professor. You know, his age is they can't tell what it is. And this will be something that they play with a little bit in X-Men Origins Wolverine later on. And we also get a throwaway line here that Xavier is not sure that it's Logan that Magneto really wants. Like, He's not certain that it's him, so we, you know, there is some notion that it might be, you know, it might be the girl or it might be someone else. So then we cut back to Magneto's lair and we see Senator Kelly. We see Toad using his massive tongue to eat a bird. So there's this whole sequence where he's experimenting with his machine, and this is the machine that will turn ordinary human beings into mutants, so Magneto thinks. But he wants to test it on Senator Kelly before using it at the UN at the end of the film. You know, it's great. He puts Kelly in the middle of it, and he goes up in the machine. And there's some great visual shots when the machine's in full motion. Singer shoots this low angle, and we get this very incredible, sinister look on Magneto's face, and especially at the end when he's exhausted by it. It's a very, very great visual effect of this field that emanates from this machine and slowly flows outward and envelops Kelly. And, you know, no one really knows yet what it's going to do to him. We're back with Logan and Jean. Jean has come into Logan's room to say goodnight, or they're talking about something. Again, Logan's flirting like crazy. We're told that Scott's her boyfriend, that she's telekinetic, and she has some of Xavier's powers. He asks her to read his mind, you know, very aggressively, kind of dickishly, frankly. And she starts to do it, and we see as a viewer, you know, some of the procedural visuals about him getting the adamantium grafted on his skull, his thing, which is really cool. These creepy scenes of guys, and he's in a tank and all that. It's really neat. So then Scott, of course, interrupts right when he's taking her hands off his head, so it's, you know, kind of caught in the act, so to speak. And then we get the beginning of the Cyclops-Wolverine rivalry, where Jean leaves, and Wolverine's like, "So, you're going to tell me to stay with me, girlfriend?" And he's like, "If I had to do that, she wouldn't be my girlfriend." And, of course, at the end, he's like, "Oh, and by the way, Logan, stay away from my girlfriend." So, you know, there's their initial rivalry, which is clever. So that night, Logan has these nightmares of his procedure. And Rogue sneaks into his room because she hears him yelling. And he wakes up suddenly, and his claws come out and stabs her in the shoulder. And she's in trouble. And she realizes that he needs his mutant power to heal. So she grabs him and, like, drains his power for a short time. When he wakes on the table again in the med lab, we hear about Rogue's power now for the first time, that when she touches anyone, she drains their life force. So no more metaphorical alienating power than Rogue's power, right? That actually she can't even touch people skin to skin without draining their life force. And at the same time, she also absorbs their powers for a short while she has their force in them. So very cool. So we cut back to Magneto now, and we see Senator Kelly in his cell. It's a great scene where he leans against the bars, and he realizes that his skull has become flexible. So he winds up slipping through the bars, and he's outside kind of holding on to the rocky outcropping, and Magneto comes in with Sabretooth, and he's kind of, "You're one of us now. Where would you go? Who would have you?" And a Sabretooth goes to grab him, and he slips out of his hand because he's almost jelly-like. We get this scene where he turns up naked, walking out of the water on a beach, and he looks like a living human jellyfish. And now he's subjected to the taunts and the, you know, people looking at him in disgust. Like, it's a great, like, this is how we feel, dude, you know? And there's a very, very subtle Stan Lee cameo. I think it was the first one that he did. Where he's buying a hot dog from a hot dog vendor. And you really have to look to see him. You know, in subsequent Marvel films, he's been quite impossible to miss. Like, he's become vocal, and they focus in on him now, and he does a line of some kind. And but this one is very subtle, just right in the background. You know, Singer kept it very, very subtle, which I think I like, because it keeps it focused on what it should be focused on, which is the story. So now we get this scene between who we think is Bobby, Drake and Rogue. It's actually Mystique who's taken Bobby's place. It's a tough little scene to watch because we realize Marie has really found a home here and it's going to be great for her. Bobby is basically saying, everyone's freaked out. You stole Wolverine's powers. And Anna Paquin's great. She's like, I had no choice. Nothing I can do. And Mystique pushes it, really. She's like, you should leave. You should go now. And she's very upset and she stalks off. We get a brief flash of eyeballs, which is how we know it's Mystique. It's very subtle. You have to look for it so we know it's not Bobby Drake. They find out that she's gone. We get our first viewing of Cerebro, which is this huge room where Xavier goes, and he hooks himself up to this machine, and it's allowed to extend his powers. He can locate any mutant on the planet. We find out later that he could pretty much kill every living being on the planet with Cerebro. Pretty incredible thing if you think about it. Power for him to have. And Logan follows him in. You know, he's explaining. And again, it's another dumb, goofy name that you have to deliver this information because you want to, you know, you need to have fidelity to the comics. You can't start renaming shit. You're going to alienate your biggest fan base. So I think they were smart in that they were like, look, we have to name these characters what they are and we have to call these things what they've been called. But to the vast amounts of people who've never read X-Men comics, how the hell are we going to do this? And again, they use Wolverine because he's walking in behind him. We hear Cerebro and we hear all about it. And then Logan's little quips, certainly is a big round room, right? So again, as an audience member, you can go either way, which is great. And we also get a bit of Magneto, how he shielded somehow from Charles. You know, Wolverine asks him, well, how the hell would he know how to shield from this? And he's like, well, he helped me build it. So we get this great, you know, it's very complex, the history between Xavier and Magneto, and that they were allies for a long time before being, you know, enemies. He finds her, she's at a train station, and we're going to get our first mutant-on-mutant big battle. We've had a little bit of something, you know, when Logan got killed, but not much. So now we're going to get our first, you know, mano-a-mano battles. So the professor doesn't want Logan out of the mansion because he feels like this is a feint to get that, you know, Magneto will be able to get to him. So he sends Storm and Cyclops, but of course, you know, Logan steals Cyclops' motorcycle. And there's this great moment where Cyclops and Storm are walking to a car to leave, and we see Scott like, where's my motorcycle? And then we cut to Logan on it, and he hits like the turbo and he smiles. Like, it's a fun moment. And now, at the same time, Mystique, being in the mansion, impersonates Xavier. So she becomes him for a second. So in order to get Cerebro, it has to do an optical scan of Xavier, and then it will open up. So she kind of mimics him to that extent, gets into Cerebro, and injects some kind of fluid into Cerebro, and then kind of leaves. So we get that little bit of a setup. Rogue is on a train. I don't know if she's going north or where she's going, but Grand Central, Rogue's on a train, and Wolverine finds her first, enters the train, and they sit together. And they have this nice moment, you know, which harkens back to their moment in the truck early on. Like, you know, it's really sweet. Like, you're running again, kid? Yeah, you know. But Wolverine, his character gets a little rounder where he's like, look, you know, there's not too many people who are going to understand what you're going through. And I think this guy Xavier is one of them. I really think he wants to help. So, like, even though he's been the brash, cocky, cynical guy about the whole team and everything, like he kind of knows what's up. Like, he's not an idiot. Like, and he recognizes that Xavier is like the real deal. So it's a really good scene. You know, as fans, I don't know. It's like, it's a cool scene when you see that connection. Actually, in the station proper, Cyclops and Storm are looking around for her, and Sabretooth and Toad go after them. So first, Sabretooth goes after Storm, and he basically chokes her and then throws her halfway across the room, and she's kind of powerless. She's kind of powerless, you know, unless she's ready with her, like, weather stuff. You know, Storm is kind of a waste. It always, like, she always has to kind of gear up these big moments, you know. But, like, when she's individual against other mutants, she's kind of a tough character to field in a movie because she always comes late to the game and then, you know, kicks the shit out of everybody. But there's this great moment, though, where Toad strips off Cyclops' visor, and before he can do anything about it, his eye blasts blow a hole in the top of the train station, which is really, I mean, it's the scale of that is pretty, and the power, right, I think is really amazing. It's the CGI is not that great because they didn't give Singer a lot of money here, so he had to do the best he could. But still, the scale of it, that one small blast from this guy's optics can blow a hole in the top of the train station, it's pretty cool. Like, it gives you step back a moment, and you're like, holy cow, man, this stuff is powerful. You know, these creatures are powerful. So he has to shut his eyes. He's kind of out of the game. Storm's eyes finally go white, you know, because of the hole now in the top of the station. She's able to call down lightning, and she zaps Sabretooth, and he's down for the count. Then we're back on the train. Wolverine and Rogue are about to leave, and here comes Magneto, and he rips the train in half and enters, like, floating. Very cool. He levitates Wolverine, and he's like, does that wonderful metal go throughout your entire body? Like, he's completely powerless against Magneto. Then we get this great reversal where he's like, what do you want with me? He's like, who said I want anything with you? And he blasts him backwards, and he realizes that they're after Rogue. So ejects her with a sedative, and then our second setup is that, you know, all of our X-Men are kind of down for the count. We see Magneto, Toad, and Sabretooth come out of the station carrying Rogue. So as the three are outside, the police are arrayed for battle, right, as they exit. There's another great scale scene, and again, it's done without any music or any fanfare. Magneto just raises his arms, and two cop cars just fly up in the air, turn over, and come back down and smash on two other cop cars. And I like that it's done without a big dramatic flourish, you know, that it's just done matter-of-factly. And again, it's the power of these, you know, between Scott poking a hole in the station and Magneto lifting cars seemingly effortlessly, it's incredible, like, how powerful they are. And of course, all their guns come out, and then there's this great line, you homo sapiens and your guns. And, you know, because he controls metal, all the guns leave the hands of the cops, turn around, and they cock, and they start to float forward, pointing at their owners. It's just really amazing. And then in a moment, Sabretooth's hand goes around his neck. We hear Charles' voice kind of in there, you know, let them go, Eric. Toad says the same thing. We see Toad looking at him like, yeah, you should let them go, you know. Let her go and let them go. Then we, you know, Charles is out there in a cop car just sitting somewhere and he's not seen. And we hear, you know, Magneto say, why don't you show yourself, Charles? Magneto won't back down. And so he discharges a firearm and the bullet is spinning and he's controlling the bullet slowly, faster and faster towards a guy's head. And at the same time, Xavier's controlling Toad and he's walking away with Rogue. And there's this moment of like, make your choice, Charles. There's a lot of these guns. I don't think I could stop all the bullets. Charles relents, and he lets go of control of the two men. All of a sudden, you know, Mystique arrives with a helicopter, and they all jump in and get out. And, you know, we hear Magneto kind of cackling, still unable to make sacrifices, right? And off he goes. But the scale of it, there's something about how he shot this scene and how matter-of-factly Magneto's powers manifest themselves that it's done really well. I can't, you know, he shoots kind of medium shots on the guns. It's not done like a director saying, wow, look at these mutant powers, right? It's done very matter-of-factly. And I think the impact is greater because of it, because we're not being cued by music or by big flourishing shots. This stuff just happens out of nowhere. And I think it kind of takes you aback when you see it. You're just like, oh, because it's a very mundane scene. It's a couple of people walking around, and then all of a sudden two cars are going up in the air, you know, and there's like two dozen, you know, weapons being flipped around in the air. And it's just, I just find it's fantastically done and just keeps it very, very believable for me. So now back at the mansion, the X-Men are all arguing and Wolverine's out of there and he's like, I'm going to go search for her on my own. And he's like, you know, are you guys on the right side? Maybe Magneto's right. You know, this school is a joke, blah, 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 blah. And then before he leaves, the door opens and Senator Kelly's there. Xavier reads his memories, and he sees the machine and everything that happened, which is really cool. And there's more clarity about the machine here because we now get the information that it emits radiation that causes mutation because we get a little more of the scene that we saw the first time. But from what they can tell doing a scan of Kelly, it's an unnatural mutation, so the body rejects it, which this is something that Magneto does not know. But we also understand that Xavier can tell that powering up the machine nearly killed Magneto. So they figure out why he needs Rogue and that he's going to transfer his powers to Rogue. She'll power the machine. You know, it'll kill her and then he'll just recover his powers back, which is just, you know, creepy and clever at the same time. And then there's this scene of Kelly laying on the table just with Storm. His body slowly just becomes water, completely discombobulates on the table and is gone. And she runs out, tell him that he's dead. Now Xavier goes back into Cerebro because they need to find Rogue. And so they want Wolverine in on the search. He's like, take him with you. And Scott's like, why? He's totally unpredictable. He's not part of the team. And he's like, you know, he deserves to be there. You're going to need him on this. And then we see, as he uses Cerebro, that that trap that was laid earlier by Mystique sort of comes to fruition, and he's incapacitated completely. And Jean goes in, fixes the machine, and actually uses it. And it's very hard for her to control. So it really messes her up. But she does it, and she finds Marie, and she knows everything that's going to happen. So then we cut to a ferry by the Statue of Liberty, and we see Magneto's team is infiltrating, you know, everywhere, and they're killing guys and bringing this device, which is going to masquerade as the torch. I guess it's going to go underneath the torch, and Magneto somehow will lift it up into place with his powers, making it not easy to spot. And it's evening anyway, right? It's a very odd thing that they would do it in that way, but it is a comic book movie, right? So then we're back at the mansion. We get this plan. You know, the men, they're planning how they're going to take him down. And there's this cool little war board that looks like, I don't know, like it's a bunch of metal rods and it's being controlled. I don't know why it's being controlled, but they're, you know, there's this whole thing about how they're going to insert into the, you know, Liberty Island and where they're going to land. It's very cool. So they all suited up and they're in the jet. And Wolverine, of course, you know, He's buttoning up his uniform and it doesn't fit too well. He's like, you actually go out outside of these things. And then we get Scott Summers saying, what do you expect, yellow spandex? Again, that's the writer speaking directly to the fans, the big fans, you know, because there was a lot of yellow spandex, especially Wolverine. In the classic iteration of these characters, they were drawn in wacky ways. You know, Singer rightly so kept it all very muted and subtle. Otherwise, it would have been, you know, like a Joel Schumacher film. Just again, but it's great. You know, as a fan, like you're getting a little lip service. Like, look, this we changed a few things. Don't hate us, right? So we see the backyard. Part of the backyard opens up, and this wonderful jet, which looks like a mashup of like an F-35 and an SR-71, emerges, hovering and takes off. Storm raises a fog to cover them as they kind of come into Liberty Island. Then this funny scene where they all walk in. They all walk through the metal scanners, and Wolverine walks through, and it lights up. And, of course, he has to extend his claws and crash it. Scott turns around and look at him like, come on, dude. And he retracts the two outside claws, and the middle one stays up, and it gives him the finger. Like, so funny, you know. They started, you know, these jokes come here and there, but they're very welcome when they're coming. They're very sharp and very funny. As we're watching them walk away, what we thought, they're passing what looks like a sort of person-sized statue of the Statue of Liberty, and it's actually Mystique. She opens her eyes, very clever. But Logan sniffs her out, and he's like, keep your eyes open, we're not alone. And then he walks away, and then it looks like he's coming back. And then he comes, the real Wolverine comes from the side and tackles her, and we realize that now it's on. So they're battling. Toad enters then as well to engage the other three. So he kicks their butts to start. He takes Scott and Roar out straight away just by knocking him down because he's very athletic. He leaps towards Jean and she holds him up like telekinetically. He's kind of stuck up there and he spits something at her that covers her nose and mouth so she can't breathe, drops him. He beats the crap out of Storm, like really messes her up bad. And then we cut back to the Wolverine fight. And then it's you know, Wolverine versus himself. Mystique eventually morphs back into herself. And the choreography, the fight choreography between the two is really good, man. It's really just, it's solid. It's good kind of martial arts stuff. And I believe it, you know, like the hits are real. It's not super cutty. Their stunt doubles were used really well. You know, he's not very graceful, but he's very strong. And she's just ridiculously deft and flexible. So you see that she's wary of his power, but he can't pin her down because she's all over the place. So it's clever. So Storm then very dramatically rises from an elevator shaft that she was thrown down, and she's got her white eyes, and she's levitating with all this power, and she blows Toad down and out a window. He's holding onto a bar with his tongue, and she nails him with a bolt of lightning, and he is out of the game. So then we cut to Logan. This is a great scene. Behind him, we think Storm has found him, but he's smelling. We can tell he's like smelling someone. Wait, someone's here. And he turns around and stabs her. We think he stabbed Storm, right, of course, but it's Mystique. So she is down. And there's another great funny line when Logan rejoins the group. Scott puts his hand up to his visor. He's like, wait, how do we know it's you? And he goes, you're a dick. And Scott's like, okay. You know, just very deadpan. It's funny and very off the cuff. Like, they just did such a great job with it. So they ascend the Statue of Liberty. They get up to the inside the head, and Magneto is there and incapacitates all of them. They're all stuck on the side of the sort of the metal, the bronze. He's put these little bands around them by using his power. And he does it in such a way where he pulls Scott's visor off and puts him right in front of Jean. And he takes Wolverine's fists and kind of points them at his chest and then kind of uses these metal straps that are part of the statue, I guess, and holds them in place. Very clever. And then we realize that even Storm can't use her power, where he's like, this is really funny. Magneto's got some good lines here. He's like, yes, a bolt of lightning inside a copper conductor. I thought you lived at a school, you know. It's very good. Not, you know, not cackly, but very good. So then we get this great thing, but Magneto's like, you know, I want you guys to understand what I'm doing here. Like, I'm for mutants, you know. It's, this is all for us. And then Wolverine just cuts him to pieces, where he's like, you're so full of shit. If you're really so, you know, magnanimous or sacrificing, it'd be you in that thing, not her. And he's right, you know. Like, he just cuts Magneto out completely, and we know that he is power mad. Like, and he's using this whole mutant thing. But it wouldn't end there. It's great. It's just a great way of stripping bare his real motives. It's really clever. Rogue and Magneto are now up in the machine, and she's screaming at the top of her lungs, and Logan flips out. He can't take it, so he extends his claws through his chest, pushing against the metal behind him, knocking him out of his restraints, and he's on the floor for the moment, passed out. And Sabretooth is there watching him. You know, Sabretooth kind of comes up to Storm, and he's like, you owe me a scream, but then, you know, Wolverine is now up, and he's like, hey, bub. And I think the bub was, I think Jackman had studied Wolverine and was using bub in a lot of the scenes, and they cut most of it, but they left this one in. So his bub was a leave-in, which is great because, again, it's the character, right? That's Wolverine. So then we have this site, Wolverine and Sabretooth on the, you know, on the torch of the Statue of Liberty. And it's not a great fight. You know, it's like when you know that neither combatant really has a firm footing. This, I don't know, the fight feels just very superficial to me. And there's some cool moments of, you know, Wolverine kind of spinning around, lopping off one of the spikes because of, you know, there's no sense of real kineticism in this fight or power. Like, none of them can really stand up there. Then Sabretooth throws Wolverine off, and he thinks he's won. So he comes back in, and he's teasing Storm, and he enters. Wolverine comes in, and he has Scott's visor this time. Jean controls it and gets it right on his face, and he opens it up and blasts Sabretooth out of the torch, and now he's out of the fight. But at this point, Magneto and Rogue have already started, so they're up there, and the machine is starting, and you know, they're trying to figure out how to stop it. It's very cool. So they have Storm levitate him up there. He jumps up on top, and he's about to stick his claws into the spinning machine. It's kind of like a big spinning gyroscope. But Magneto still has some of his power left, and there's this moment now, it's very tension-filled, where he's holding Wolverine's claws from going in, and Wolverine's kind of stuck, and this field is being generated now, and it's moving towards the, you know, the UN. There's a lot of tension. Scott finally gets this shot, and he takes it, and he knocks Magneto out of the game. You know, Logan now is able to destroy the machine, and big explosion. And, I mean, in terms of third act stuff, it's not that impressive. I mean, you know, this movie pales in comparing, in terms of last act action scenes, it pales probably in comparison with all the other ones, for sure. I mean, Singer didn't have the money that a lot of these other films had, and Singer didn't have Singer's film to draw from either. So I give him a huge break with this last scene. You know, people give this movie a lot of grief because of this last action scene, but it's done so much so well up till now that, you know, it's fine. There'll be plenty more, you know. It's very cool. We also see Rogue's hair turn white in one scene because of the machine that's really drained her. So we think she's dead. Wolverine's with her. And, you know, there's this great last after the action sequence where, you know, he's holding her. And then finally she wakes up and she drains his power, like a lot of it. And we see that he starts to bleed because his power is now being transferred to her and he doesn't have it to heal himself. But she's back in power. You know, it's a great dramatic moment and using the powers for that purpose. Like, he'll sacrifice himself for her and she's able to take it on straight away. Very cool. One thing that's a little weird is that, you know, at the end of this, like, we see Mystique has turned herself into a guard and is going to be carried out. But, like, you know, he stabbed her in the gut with a three-clawed, you know, claw of his and doesn't even flinch. Like, she survives, no problem. So, it's like, I guess they could have figured out another way to incapacitate her, but, like, being gutted by Wolverine and then just getting up, somehow healing yourself, like, I don't buy it. Back at the School for the Gifted, Xavier wakes up. Wolverine winds up healing himself, and he tells Jean, you know, how he feels, but before she can say anything back, he changes the subject, so we get that set up. We get a brief throwaway that Alkali Lake is something that Xavier has found in Wolverine's memory, and that's his next step. He's going to head out there. which is a perfect lead into X2. And then we see briefly on television, Mystique has taken the form of Senator Kelly, and she voted the bill down, so the bill is now gone in terms of compulsory mutant registration. And we get this brief flash of her yellow eyes, and they freeze it, and it's like, Mystique. And then we get Rogue and Wolverine part, you know, and she's like, you're coming back, gives her his dog tags. Nice scene. You know, their relationship is very sweet in that, like, he's not going to mess with that, and she definitely has a crush on him. But he's being very chivalrous towards her, and it's really awesome. It's great about Wolverine that he does right. He can be a dick, you know. He's already a very, very cool character. And the last great moment with him is he walks out and he looks at Scott's motorcycle, raises his eyebrows, and then there's this great epilogue where they put Magneto in this white plastic prison, and they're playing chess. You know, this Lucite chess set looks very cool. You know, Eric's like, why do you keep coming here, Charles? You know, I'm looking for hope. But Magneto kind of is like, look, this prison isn't going to hold me forever. There's a war coming, and I intend to fight it. And then Charles kind of mans up at this point, and he's like, well, I will always be there, old friend, to stop you, you know? And it's great. Because as Charles walks out, we see on the board that he won the game, and, you know, Magneto knocks the king over. And awesome, you know? It's a great... Xavier finally kind of, like, steps up. So, and then the film ends. So... a lot to say about this film because I, you know, in re-looking at it and then taking a look at where it came in terms of comic book movies, I realized what an incredibly important part it played. You know, the casting of this film was next to perfect. There was in a role that was out of place. Everyone was perfect. The subtlety and the matter-of-fact way that Singer approaches everything, to me, was brand new. I mean, you had not seen that before. The costume design and and not going crazy, not doing Batman or Batman Returns. The mansion, how it's set in such mostly in a real situation. There's not a lot of really heightened crazy fantasy stuff. Again, the themes of alienation and really works through the film of like, you know, you can take it as a gay allegory. You can take it as a teenage allegory. You could take it as a black allegory. You could take it as a Jew allegory. Like, it, you know, you name it. It's there, you know. And I think it's a wonderful way of making this film very accessible, not just as like lots of film goers who like action, but that metaphor is available to a lot of different groups who come to this movie and will see it and can freely engage with it, you know, and connect to it. So I think that's very sharp, very sharp. And having Magneto be, you know, we understand why he is the way he is. Like anyone surviving a concentration camp. I mean, come on, you know. So to make the villain a very complicated character and start the movie with his backstory, I mean, holy cow, it's pretty amazing. You know, this film sets out the thematic carpet that all of the rest of the X-Men films work on. X2, Last Stand, First Class, Days of Future Past, and probably Apocalypse, although Apocalypse looks to be more of a like mutants versus mutants movie. But those four movies were all about society versus the mutants and that they were outcasts and this wasn't fun to have these powers. Like you didn't have friends. Actually, you might have been, you know, on the run from the law. And that was all set up by Singer and his writers in this first film. So I cannot underestimate the impact of this thing. I want to talk more about that especially. So you have to remember that before Singer's X-Men, which came out in 2000, right? What superhero films did we have? Right? Think about it. We had 1978 with Superman and Superman 2, Richard Donner films, which were great, right? Then from the late 70s, we had Batman 1989, which was the beginnings of the darkening of the landscape, right? But it was still a costume ball, if it were. In 1989, we also have Dolph Lundgren's Punisher, which was a ridiculously B-crime movie. Which did nothing to do any justice to any character. We had Darkman. We had The Rocketeer. In 92, we had the Batman sequel, Batman Returns, which was basically a costume ball. We had The Crow, The Shadow, and then, you know, Schumacher's Batmans, and then Stallone's Judge Dredd, Spawn, Steel. Those were the comic book movies that we had before X-Men that were, you know, playing around with the genre. No one knew what to do about it. No one had the balls to take it seriously. Burton did a little bit, and Donner did with Superman as well. I think the two Superman films up until that point were probably the best. And then Burton did with Batman, but it was still half serious, half like the Party Man sequence that Jack Nicholson's Joker engages in, right? And a lot of the planes and guns and all the stuff, it's very much just like a fantasy film. You know, it's not really tethered in realism. Although there was emotional realism in Batman, you know, and Bruce Wayne was a complex character, and I think Keaton was terrific. The second film was all about the villains and the cackling henchmen, and I thought was just not as good. And then Schumacher's films were a joke. I mean, they just were a joke. And then all these other films that, you know, The Crow tried to do atmosphere. The Shadow tried to do it for real, you know. But the only two films that preceded Singer that I think he probably pulled from were Blade and The Matrix. And, you know, Blade is technically a comic book movie, right? It's more about vampirism, but he's a comic book hero for sure. And the Blade film to me is a landmark. It's an amazing film. It's the first time, I mean, Goyer really understood, because he's such a geek, that you got to take this, you got to be dead serious about this. An approach that hasn't been tried, is you got to take this stuff dead seriously and you got to think it through. So for Blade, you had the first time, to me, the Nolan's Batman's come out of Blade, because Blade, they thought everything through. It's like garlic had its a different name. The blood, the things that with blood and garlic and the technical things and the science behind some of it, it starts in a morgue. You know, like Blade really, to me, Blade is, and I'll get to Blade eventually. It's an incredibly landmark film, and I think a lot of people pull from Norrington and Blade. And then The Matrix for fighting, right? The Matrix put fighting on the map. The Blade fights were great, too. Actually, the Blade and Matrix came out within a year of each other. It's incredible. And they both, like, upped the game for fight sequences in comic book movies, because, you know, what fight sequences did you have in Batman? They were useless. So that was the playing field, right? And then in 2000 comes X-Men, and everything came after X-Men. The Spider-Man movies, the Marvel continuity, you know, the Marvel Universe movies, Fantastic Four movies, Nolan's Batman movies, you know, this whole DC continuity is starting up now, all after. And I feel like what Singer did with X-Men was templated by every of the studios. They looked at this film and they saw, holy shit, you know, we can do this. It can be funny. We can make it very realistic. We can have jokes in there. And as the CGI gets better, we can have more and more heroes in our movies. And, you know, we can make the CGI look almost seamless. I mean, Marvel has perfected what I think X-Men started. But Singer was the first one who had the stones to go at it in that way. I think, again, Goyer and Blade, I don't know if it's, I'd have to ask him, right? But to me, he must have seen Blade and he must have seen Goyer's approach. And I have to believe that Blade influenced X-Men. But X-Men did so many things for the first time with a set of heroes that were hallowed comic book heroes that no one ever thought you could bring the X-Men to life on a big screen. It's going to be stupid. No one will get it, you know. And, you know, I have to put this film very high up in the pantheon of comic book movies. It was a landmark. Blade and X-Men, landmark comic book films, and that they laid out the palette that everyone else stole from going forward. So in that way, I think it's great. It's not as, you know, X2, the sequel to X-Men, I think is a better film. It's a better plot. They're not burdened with origin stories for the most part, so they have more room to run. You've been introduced to these characters. Singer knew what he was doing. It's probably a better movie overall. Ratner's X3, X-Men United, the through line of the story is great, but Ratner's execution to me is pretty terrible. First Class, solid, very solid. I like it a lot. Days of Future Past, I was a little let down by. I didn't think it was that great. I still think X2 and First Class were better films, and I wasn't too happy with it. And I'm sure Apocalypse will be fine, as they've teased. And then there are, you know, the Wolverine movies, which I'll get into eventually. But yeah, big fan of X-Men, and I think he did a great job. So that's this edition of Sci-Fi on Screen, covering Singer's 2000 movie epic, X-Men. I want to thank you all for listening. You can find us on scifionscreen.com. You can find us on iTunes, Audio Boom, any podcast app that is on a smartphone. You can search for us and subscribe. We upload episodes every week. So thanks again for listening. Looking forward to next time.